Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by the new term at FXPhD.com. Among the new courses this term, our new Katana Lighting Training, a world first with Matt Leonard. Included in that is free VPN access to a full version of Katana, along with many other key programs to help you learn, such as Arnold, Maya, Nuke, Cinema 4D, and many more. They're all there to help you take your career to the next level. Check it all out at fxphd.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. That's right, I'm back. The flu's been plaguing everyone here in the United States, so I hope you are avoiding it wherever you may be. We do several podcasts here. This is the FX podcast. It's where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We like to dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. Be sure to check out all of our podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. So today's podcast is another in our series covering the awards season for this year. At this year's SciTech Awards, visual effects supervisor and director of photography Bill Taylor has been voted the John A. Bonner Medal of Commendation by the Board of Governors of the Academy. This award is named in honor of the late director of special projects at Warner Hollywood Studios. The John A. Bonner Medal is awarded for outstanding service and dedication and upholding the highest standards of the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences. Bill Taylor is our guest today, and this podcast has been a long time coming. When I first moved to L.A. almost 20 years ago, I attended one of the my first visual effects bake-off and noticed that one person was asking the first question during the Q&A section for each film, and they were all great questions. I found out that was Bill Taylor, and after doing some research, I was further impressed. Bill owned Illusion Arts with Sid Dutton, which operated for 26 years, and Bill and Sid worked together before that at Universal for 10 years. I think you're going to really like this interview. It's got lots of talk about the nitty-gritty of everything we do in visual effects, as well as some amazing history and a fantastic perspective with a real voice of experience on issues that our industry faces today. So without further ado, let's jump into Mike Seymour speaking with Bill Taylor.
Bill, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and congratulations on being recognized by the Academy.
Thank you.
Though it's not the first time you've been recognized by the Academy. In fact, you've won a SciTech Award, haven't you?
Many years ago, yes, for an optical printer, a design of a technology that's completely obsolete.
That was in 1982, and it was actually for a two-format rotating head aerial image optical printer. And I'd like to confess my ignorance as to the details of that specific optical printer. What was that?
Well, that was an optical printer because when I was at I designed that printer when I was at Universal Studios, or rather, I called out the specifications for it. The actual designs were created by Doug Fries, a real engineer, and built by George Randall, a great machinist. But the Universal department at which I worked, we worked in two major 35mm formats. We worked in regular 4-perf, which is where the negative travels from top to bottom and is pulled down 4 perforations at a time. The image is roughly an inch wide and maybe 3/4 inch tall and very very rough figures. There's all sorts of formats that can be laid into the 4 perforation image, but that's the main negative format. Then the other negative format that we worked in is what's called VistaVision, or 8-perf, where each frame is the size of a film transparency. That is, the image is 8 perforations long, the film is pulled across, and that yields an aspect ratio of about 1.7 to 1. Kind of close. It's a little taller than high definition, but turned out to be a very good format to work in for visual effects because you got twice the resolution on each frame of film.
And by its very nature, the optical printing process involves interpoles and interneg, and so the more resolution and lack of grain visible due to that density.
Exactly right. All optical printing, or most optical printing at least, the optical printing that results in the dupe negative that's cut into a movie involves copying images from various positive images onto a duplicate negative, and of course that duplicate negative is at best a full generation away from the original photography. So you want the best possible photography to begin with to make sure that the dupe negative doesn't show a hit in quality when it's cut into the film.
Now, am I right in thinking that a younger version of you on the issue of dupes or the look of dupes called up industry legend, I don't know how to describe him, Al Whitlock, to, I mean, that's how you got kind of started, because you phoned him up and asked him about dupes, is that right?
That's exactly right. Well, what I said was I had seen a film on which he worked, a rather innocuous comedy called That Funny Feeling. But the film was shot in the Universal backlot, very identifiable to me. I was already working in the film industry at that point. And suddenly on would come these magnificent wide shots in which suddenly the Universal backlot seemed to be in the middle of a very beautiful version of Manhattan. And I realized they had to be matte paintings, but I'd never seen matte paintings of that quality before, not only the quality of the painting, but the quality of the photographic image, which was absolutely inseparable or indetectable as being different from the original photography that surrounded it. And, of course, as my phone conversation with Al Whitlock quickly informed me, that was because Al Whitlock continued to work on original negative, and which was the original method for doing matte painting shots, where the live action is photographed with a matte or a black card, let's say, blocking out the part of the scene that you don't want to photograph. And later, in a separate exposure back in the laboratory, after the painting is prepared, the painting is double exposed into that unexposed area.
But I think we should really take a moment to just underline that, because what we're talking about here is a director has got a pass, or a take, I should say, that he loves. This is the take. This is the only copy of this performance. And Al's going to take that original camera negative with this blacked out section and expose something onto it, which means if he got it wrong, you had absolutely no safety net.
Well, that's not quite true. We always had at least two good takes. The directors who knew Al and knew the quality that he could achieve were more than willing to play along. And so the directors were always willing to give us two good takes.
But they were two original takes. It wasn't a,
that's
there was
right.
no
two,
duplication.
Two original takes. And of course, Al had, of course, original negative. Even by the time I joined Al in 1974 or 5, I guess, by then the original negative matte technique was 60 years old, at least 60 years old, because it seems to have been invented by Norman Dawn at Universal Studios, incidentally, in the silent days. And so with that 60 years of aggregate knowledge and some really rigorous safety procedures and precautions which Al had created, we were pretty darn sure by the time we threaded up that original take in the camera that we were going to get the result we were expecting. And in fact, during my entire time at Universal Studios and afterward, because we continued to do original negative shots at Illusion Arts even after we had gotten into motion control and rear projection and all sorts of then exotic technologies, we still recognized that you just can't beat original quality. And then, in fact, it wasn't until we saw a really good digital copy at Eastman Kodak back in the early 80s that we realized that there was actually a way out of this dilemma, and it was going to be possible very soon to do copies that were indistinguishable from the original.
Well, I still think that you're being modest. I did a reasonably simple comp the other day. I think we went to 26 versions before it was final. The thought that you would commit to one and that it would work
Well, don't forget, these were, for the most part, very simple shots. You know, it was a wide, in the first place, there's rarely anything of great dramatic import that happens in a wide shot. Okay, that's the first issue. The second issue, or perhaps I should say of great dramatic subtlety. And the second issue is that the shot was, for editing purposes, the shot was usually covered by a second camera from the side, not at precisely the ideal angle, but perhaps as close to our camera as they could physically get. In fact, we would sometimes bring two cameras onto the set. And the third factor is that as long as the dupe negative hadn't been destroyed, as long as the original matte painting negative hadn't been physically destroyed, you always had the option of going to a second generation and inserting the visual effects in that second generation negative.
Well, I'm going to come back and discuss films from that era in a second, but I wanted, if I can, not to just focus on technology. I thought move off at a bit of a tangent for a second to discuss some of the craft. Now, of course, you're very closely associated with matte painting, though your background is actually that of being a matte photographer, if I was to be accurate.
Yes, that's right. I was Al Whitlock. I mean, you know, My entree into feature films really was Al Whitlock, and who, as you mentioned, I met him because of a cold call, and eventually we became friends. And years after that, he hired me when his cameraman retired, and then I went into business with Sid Dutton, who was Al's who was the artist that Al trained. And Al and Sid, of course, was by that time an absolutely first-rate mad artist in his own right. And then we hired people like Robert Stromberg and Kelvin McElwain and Mike Wassell, who were just superb, absolutely top-notch artists. And so I've been around matte paintings all my life, and I love working with artists. I just love it.
Well, as I said, I'm going to discuss those films in a second and that amazing set of people that you worked with. But I wanted to discuss with this eye, because you obviously are recognized as an international expert in green screen, blue screen photography and shooting matte paintings and stuff. And I wanted to discuss it because there was an interview you did a little while ago, and if I could just quote something that you said at that time, which I believe is accurate. Somebody asked you basically about this idea of what you would say to somebody, I guess like me, who's only really known digital, and the advice you gave was to look at the paintings of great artists like Turner and Constable and understand what they are doing with light, color, composition. And you said, follow Percy Day's technique passed on to Ellen Shaw and Whitlock. Start with the big brush, get the composition, tone, color right for the whole image, and don't worry about the details. And I wondered if I could, in light of that quote of yours, just discuss the craft and the
I was really quoting Al Whitlock and years of watching people who had been trained by him work.
Well, let's discuss that just for a second before we get back to the films. I mean, a lot of people obviously they put together Turner and Constable, although their work is actually quite different, obviously.
Oh, heavens yes.
One makes you want to go on holidays, the other one makes you want to get out an umbrella.
Yeah, I think Albert Locke would have liked that joke. And I mentioned Turner and Constable in the same breath because Whitlock always did. Those were the two English artists that he admired most. Although he loved many of the great landscapists like Bierstadt and the Hudson River School.
There are people like Monet. I mean, I look at the Haystacks, for example, and this is not an original thought, but his ability to get the right tonal colors and shades in the shadows and stuff, all of that is very relevant to the art of the compositor trying to match up two images, isn't it? This idea, I mean, obviously we can admire Constable's or Turner's clouds, for example, and their magnificent environments, but that ability to handle shades, to handle the way that the light is working, and I guess the quality of light is something we don't discuss very much. And I was wondering if I could get your thoughts on it.
Well, again, you know, oddly enough, almost everything I know about photography I learned from a painter. That is that, you know, who told me to pay attention, and especially pay attention to compositional geniuses like Turner. You always know where to look in a Turner painting. I mean, he grabs you by the scruff of the neck and says, this is it. This is the important bit. And Monet exactly right. These people understood the effect of light on objects and light in the physical world. I, a side note, I was watching Al painting something. He was painting a match shot for Catch 22, Mike Nichols' film, and he was painting a little Italian village on a hillside. I said, "What are you painting there?" I said, "I don't know." He says, "I'm just painting light," and that's it. You know, he was painting the effect of light, and his sort of visual shorthand for what light looked like. Now, one of the things I learned from Al, and it was so important to me in learning to light foregrounds and light, you know, simulated sunlight, is you know, we were out somewhere, and he said, "Now look in the shadow of this white building that's sitting on the green grass." "Do you see how green those shadows are at the base of the building?" He said, "Yeah." "So the lights, at least, the light's bouncing off. So the light's bouncing off the grass." I said, "Well, a person standing there would also have green light coming up into him from the bottom. It might not be the prettiest light in the world, but that's what makes him look like he's really there." Likewise, Al said, "You notice as this white building goes up toward the second story, you notice how the green fades out and it becomes increasingly blue, and that's because it's lit more and more and more by the skylight." And, of course, skylight is intensely blue compared to sunlight. Thousands of degrees of Kelvin in the Kelvin color temperature measurement method. So if you're going to light somebody standing on grass First of all, he should only have one light on him. If he's supposed to be realistically lit by the sun, he should only have one light on him. It should be coming from the right place, you know, when compared to the background that he's going into. And secondly of all, the fill light on his fill side, the shadow side, it better reflect his environment. It should better reflect what he's supposed to be standing in. And so, you know, and that's usually that's just as, you know, as simple as, you know, putting a piece of cloth down on the floor or standing him on a piece of grass mat and making sure that the fill light is very warm compared to the key light, and so on. And these are the things, these are the subconscious cues that tell you right away when a shot is not real. One of the most beautiful shots I've ever had anything to do with, although I didn't do the original photography, is the famous shot in Out of Africa, where Robert Redford and Meryl Streep are flying in his plane, and he reaches back over his head and to the rear cockpit and holds her hand. Well, it's a beautiful shot, but it is unconvincing because it was lit, not because I did the composite, although I didn't do the original lighting, and I think the composite's pretty good if I do say so. But the shot is not convincing because it's designed to make the actors look good and not make the lighting realistic. And there's always that push and pull, you know, between, you know, realism and sometimes beauty, because sometimes sunlight, you would never put an actress in direct sunlight because the light's very harsh.
And yet it's not uncommon for a compositor to suppress the key color, where obviously sometimes it's better to actually take the key color and make that bounce that is happening the right color for the background rather than just pull it out to gray
you obviously have to be aware of what's going on in the background, and if the original photography didn't help you, which it certainly should, but if the original photography didn't help you, then you've got to do whatever you can to make it work. Sometimes that means heroic measures in pulling separate keys for shadows and trying to put the right color into shadows if it isn't there at the beginning. And many software packages, for example, have a little feature which can produce sort of an ambient glow around the edge of a foreground green screen composite. And if it's used tastefully, it can look good, but it's never as good as the real thing.
So you also in that quote mentioned Percy Day, who's a British map painter. I think he died the year I was born, I think. But he's not that widely known, obviously outside special and visual effects, though. I think it was
first of all he was a member of the Royal Academy. He was a famous man in England. He was a famous painter, and a portrait artist. He has several paintings in the National Gallery. You know, great of the great and good of his day. So he was a magnificent portrait artist in addition to being a matte painter.
Yeah, I think the Independent actually said he was on par with Millais as one of the great special effects painters of all time.
He's on a par with any of them. He's on a par with the greatest portrait, in my opinion. He's on a par with the greatest portraitists of all time. It's his sheer technique and his ability to grasp a personality. I mean, his portraits just crackle. And he was a great, great matte artist, and he was Peter Ellenshaw's stepfather.
And what I think's interesting about that school of approach, and certainly what I feel like we don't think about that much today, is that many of these matte paintings, if you were to stand in front of them, and I've obviously been fortunate enough to visit places that have some original matte paintings, and you can stand in front of them and you can look at them and you say, well, this is like an impressionist painting. This is not a photorealistic painting. And yet when I watched this comped into a scene, I completely bought it. I wondered if you could talk to this idea that whole school of matte painting artists that you were photographing really weren't obsessed with fine detail sort of photorealism.
First of all, that to a man, they seem to have all come from scenic painting. So if you're painting a gigantic scenic backing that's 500 feet wide and, you know, 150 feet tall, you've got to use a big brush. You can't be obsessed with detail or you'll never get done. So these guys, Percy Day, Peter Ellenshaw, Al Whitlock, and then the scenic artists who trained him in England, that's the first lesson. Use a big brush, and then paint detail only where you know the eye is going to go. You can do so. You're absolutely right. The paintings of Alan Shaw and Whitlock and Sid Dutton and Robert Stromberg and Mike Pangrazio and any number of great other contemporary artists, mad artists, is highly impressionistic. And in fact, Al Whitlock discovered that if you started to, you know, he said, first of all, if you try to paint every brick in a brick building, you'll never finish. And if you do it, everything starts to look stiff. Because if you try to paint every brick, the little sort of inconsistencies in hand painting anything begin to stand out, and you don't get a realistic look. So it's not only painting impressionistically for matte painting is not only a time saver, it's kind of essential. And then you put the detail in architecture and you know, places where you know the eye is where the eye is going to look during the scene.
So let's talk about the first photographic matte painting job you did with Whitlock, which I believe was Hindenburg in 75. I mean,
that's right.
Was that an instant education? Because obviously there's a quite complex.
Well, of course, I had known Al quite well up to that point. I had followed his progress closely on Earthquake, which was the film immediately preceding. So I had known Al very well up to that time, and so I always, we kept in touch every month or so, and had lunch or something. And Ross Hoffman retired at the end of Earthquake, and I came on board. And I still had, and of course, Ross's camera assistant, Mike Morimarco, stayed on, so I was able to make the transition, pretty seamlessly.
And the next year, in 76, you're working with Hitchcock on Family Plot, are you not?
Yes, that's right. I can't say that I worked with Hitchcock. Al worked with Hitchcock, and I met Hitchcock. I think I had probably two meals with him total. One of them at a banquet, I can say truthfully that I spoke to Hitchcock on several occasions.
So would begin a long reign of working with very good directors that you've obviously worked with in various capacities as you were working either at the photographing miniatures, live action, or matte painting. I wondered if we could discuss a couple of those.
Sure.
And maybe in a little depth, because I know people would be interested in the details. I was fascinated a couple of years later after you'd done a bunch of things like Airport 77. You did the Blues Brothers, I believe. Can you talk to us about...
Yes.
That work with, again, a very good director.
Yes, well, in the first place, John Landis is one of the people I like tremendously. So he's, I've worked on maybe four of his movies, I guess, and he's great fun to work with, and he has a really original take on things. We didn't do very much in Blues Brothers, a couple of matte paintings, I think,
Didn't you really blow up the set?
That was Al's brilliant idea. John had to blow up the building. John, given that it was the Blues Brothers, was quite prepared to blow up a derelict building in Chicago. In fact, Chicago was going to let him do it because they were going to demolish it anyway. But it was discovered that this building sat atop disused gas mains. And they were thinking, oh boy, you know, we might be, if we're not careful, we might be blowing up more than this building. So John came to Al, and I believe at this point that John had a dummy explosion cut into the movie from another film. I hope I'm telling the story correctly. I'll have to call John and ask him. But at any rate, Al said, looking at the real explosion, he said, look, if you cut in just at the beginning of the explosion, he said it could be anything. All you see is the explosion. You don't really see what's happening to the building. He says, as long as we see an explosion and destruction, almost anything will do. So what Al did was he had a huge frame enlargement made of the real building right from the motion picture film, a huge frame enlargement, maybe, maybe it was 20 feet wide, and had this pasted to a thin sheet of very fragile plaster, And he and others painted on this photo blow up to correct some of the more obvious artifacts of doing a huge enlargement like that. And I believe he also had several foreground pieces cut out of the same photograph and blown up separately, of course, cut out from the same photograph and put in the foreground in a slightly smaller scale. So when the debris fell, it would fall in front of and behind foreground cars.
So it was literally a set of cards, like we would think of today as digital cards, but actually real
exactly
cards.
Right. It was a set of cards, except they were made out of, the name Pyrocell comes to mind, but I don't know if that's correct. It's a very fragile, friable, brittle plaster. And this plaster, working with the visual effects guy, who I think was Glenn Robinson, they carefully glued a detonation cord, the thinnest, gentlest detonation cord, if there is such a thing, on the back of this painting. So when the det cord fired, it would shatter the plaster instantly. And that, plus a couple of gas bags in the foreground, gasoline bags, fired off by a black powder explosion. And I think it was a 1-2 punch. The gas fired, the gas fired first, and then the det cord may have fired in several sequences. The first thing that happens, of course, is there's this huge whump of very distinctive orange gasoline fire. And then the second thing, then there's a ton of smoke, and then there's a ton of debris that comes flying, at the camera. And, a shortcut was all John needed. Of course, if he had had a real building, he would have probably held on it for 20 seconds. But it was a shortcut that was all that was needed from a dramatic standpoint. And it did the job at a fraction of the cost of building a big miniature. And certainly a fraction of the cost of blowing up the real building, which might have had horrific consequences.
But I understand that on set, not when it was done, but on set, because you were shooting high speed, the effect all happened very quickly, and Landaus was, to quote one article, extremely unimpressed at the instant of the explosion.
Well, of course, because it's all over in an eye blink, and then we were rolling at 120 frames a second, which seems comically slow by today's standards, but we were rolling at 120 frames a second, and when he saw it, when he saw it in screen time, he changed his tune quickly. And in fact, we were all set to go again the next day, but it wasn't necessary.
So I'm wondering if you could talk about your relationship with Sid in light of 1982's Cat People, because Cat People seem to be a great merging of both of your talents, but of course you would work together many times. But
yeah, well, he was really coming into his own as an artist by the time of Cat People, although the first shot, which he did kind of as a solo, was on Hitchcock's Family Plot. But we have worked together very well, and we continue to work together. Sid and the company he's with now, Zoic Studios, executed many of the visual effects on Lawless, which was the last feature film I did.
And how does that working relationship go? Maybe you could describe it.
It's kind of like my working relationship with Al, in that as our skills are complementary. Sid isn't a technician, and I am, or at least to a degree. And I have a sort of broad general knowledge of motion picture technology, though I'm not particularly expert in any one field, unless it's blue screen and green screen. Sid has a very broad and encompassing knowledge of art. He draws beautifully. He paints beautifully. He's got a superb grasp of perspective and color. Our skill sets are very complementary. And he's a wonderful guy. I mean, he's just I had lunch with him today, in fact. He's just the greatest guy.
So around the time of this, Cat People was like, 1982, 1981, I think, was War, History of the World, but of the World Part 1. But at Universal, you're both there. There's basically, you've got a bit of a sprawling kind of empire, haven't you? There's like multiple kind of camera setups and camera rigs.
Compared to most of the departments, actually, our department was rather small. But we had four permanent camera setups. We had a sort of temporary camera setup kind of in the middle of things, which we would use to set up, simple motion control shots and things like that that didn't fit in any of our sort of permanent booths. Al had designed this wonderful facility specifically for cranking out original negative match shots. You know, every camera was in a lightproof booth, so we could just close the doors and thread the camera without having to get under a dark a dark cloth or anything like that. Every camera booth had a dark room directly adjacent, so we could develop little hand tests, develop little pieces of negative on the spot to make sure that things were lining up properly and get a rough idea of exposure. So it was really a very, very convenient way to work. And all the stands which held the paintings were built in several planes and had several planes of lighting: foreground, midground, background. And most of them had a huge diffuse backlight for the few dupe shots that we did. So that was a very, very convenient setup. Then for a while we had Universal for many years had a still portrait studio, I should say, on the lot, and we sort of took that over for larger setups. We put a little motion control track back there to shoot models for Dune and a few other films, and basically what we didn't realize, of course, at the start is we were sort of establishing the model for what Illusion Arts was going to be, and it's when we moved into
because Universal would close, and you basically got to buy some of the gear from Universal to set up Illusion.
They made it very easy for us to buy all we wanted. We bought pretty much the lot.
What year was that?
Oh, it was 80. Two or three, I don't remember the year, whatever the year was that Illusion Arts started.
Right.
I'm sorry, I don't have that off the top of my head.
So 1985, you received an Emmy for work with Sid, but also with Al and Mark, I believe, for AD.
That's right. Yes, in fact, I think Lynn Ledgerwood, our model maker, also won an Emmy for that show.
So AD was a period sort of Jesus of Nazareth sequel, is that right?
It was exactly right.
And what was that like to work on? What was the
well? It was a lot of fun. It was made in Tunisia, for one thing, and Tunisia at that time was a very, very good place to work. It was built on a very big scale. It was produced by a chap called Vincenzo Labella, who made a number of historical films. Vincenzo was himself a professor of history at, I think it was, the University of Rome, and he was a papal knight, tremendously qualified. We worked on several films with Vincenzo. We worked on a biography of Michelangelo for Vincenzo also. So at any rate, it was right up my alley. I love historical films. I love going to places where they speak French, which is the only foreign language I speak. And they didn't wince at my French in Tunisia as they do in France. So at any rate, it was a lot of fun. And they built gigantic sets for this movie. I don't think anything has been done like it since the days of Samuel Bronson. Of course, Samuel Bronson had this deal where he got a percentage of production costs as a part of his fee, so he had no incentive whatever to save money. I wonder where he got that deal. At any rate, Bronson didn't last long. But at any rate, we had they built some very, very big and beautiful sets And I think we did some really nice matte paintings to extend them.
Can I jump a couple of years later to 88 and Coming to America? I believe it was the first film that you were VFX supervisor on as a credit. But
would have been Brenda Starr.
Okay,
not a movie to write home about, but certainly Coming to America was an important credit for us.
And the opening sequence of Coming to America, basically from the Paramount logo, was incredible. Yes. Can you talk to me about that? Because phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, the conceit was that for the first time we see what's on the other side of the Paramount Mountain, and so the Paramount logo comes on all apparently normal, and then suddenly we fly through the lettering and over the mountain. We come onto this long apparently helicopter shot over jungle with a beautiful sort of romanticized vista and then finally onto a very sort of fantastic African, I should say, Hollywood African palace. And that was a combination of a very large foreground miniature built by our friends over at Apogee. So as I say, it was a combination of sort of panoramic map paintings, and literally put onto a curved plane because we were filming with such a wide lens. Very unusual for us to do that. The miniatures were filmed with the same lens and identical camera moves, thanks to motion control. And Apogee, the studio where we did the miniature work, was right up the street from Illusion Arts. In fact, that's why we moved Illusion Arts where we did, so we could be close to Apogee. And that was one of many, many projects we did together.
Didn't you shoot that miniature twice, like facing forward and then turned around so that you could...
That's right, exactly. It was two very large tables, and I seem to recall the tables were about 10 feet wide. And we photographed one pass going over two tables, and then we took the same two tables and pushed them 20 feet further away from the camera and filmed them again with the same, but as you say, we turned them, so we filmed them again with the same camera move. So the same miniature was able to represent twice its actual length.
And the paintings would have had to have been pretty big, right?
The paintings were not as big as we got. The paintings were a full sheet of masonite, which is 4 feet by 8 feet.
Right.
And we never got very close to the paintings because the paintings always represented the deep background.
That's actually an interesting point, because we often talk about matte paintings being on glass, but at various times you photographed glass set into masonite as well, didn't you? It wasn't just a glass painting.
That's exactly right. Boy, you've been reading the FX blog or something like that, because I've rarely gone into that detail anywhere.
Actually, the FX blog is run by a guy who works for me.
Oh, really? Oh, that's funny. The matte paintings got bigger and bigger as the film negative got bigger and bigger. And, of course, as we started pushing into the paintings in motion control, the paintings had to be more and more detailed. You have a choice between more detail and bigger, and the combination, so the result was a combination of the two. You would see Sid slaving away at a painting, wearing his close-up reading glasses and, painting with tiny little brushes, which is nothing that matters, nothing a matter artist likes to do. So at any rate, eventually the paintings got to be too big to be glass, and we moved to masonite. And for original negative, it didn't matter. When you need to backlight, however, when you need to rear project, then you need a hole in the painting, and you have to fill the painting with something. So we made it a partially glass, made a little insert, and our guy Lynn Ledgerwood came up with a way of making a completely smooth, seamless transition from masonite to a piece of glass, where there was no ridge, no bump, and it wouldn't. I don't know what he used. I think he used auto body putty, but the join wouldn't crack as the paintings aged or as they got hot under the lights, and so the result was kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, isn't it? And of course, you need that seamless transition on the foreground, but something that's being back illuminated versus front illuminated to get those to match and not look different in levels is a photographic issue of lighting, isn't it?
Yeah, and one of the biggest challenges was when we started doing rear projection matte paintings, of course, which the folks at Disney had been doing for many, many years before us, and in fact RKO had been doing for many, many years before them. And when we started doing rear projection matte paintings, so we could move again primarily so that we could do motion control moves on the paintings, we had the whole issue of trying to get a good quality dupe again, which was, we were able to get okay dupes, but we never got a great-looking dupe, I don't think. So that was the first issue. And then the second issue was just trying to make a smooth blend from a rear-projected image lit from the back to a painting lit from the front. They had to be done in separate passes. Otherwise, the painting light would wash out the screen on which the image was being projected. But, so that was a combination of photographic. Sometimes we used photographic techniques. Sid and Al developed a form of cross hatching and stippling that let them mate a join from painting to from painting to rear projection very effectively. And also, of course, we were just we always knew a shot was going to be rear projection to begin with, so we always tried to find some logical place in the image to make the transition where your eye wouldn't be just immediately drawn to it.
So 1980, sorry, you leave the 80s and hit into the 90s. In 91, you were nominated for two Emmys, basically for either parts of Best of Both Worlds, Part 1 and Part 2 for Star Trek. Was that the first time you'd worked on Star Trek? Because Star Trek would sort of reappear in various guises.
We worked on every episodic Star Trek show. Not every episode, but we worked on every show from Next Generation all the way through to Enterprise. And we had very good friends on the show, much better friends after the first couple of years. So we had a long, very productive relationship with Star Trek. In fact, very quickly they began to trust us just to design the shots. So we would very often get script pages and a quick pencil sketch from Dan Curry, the visual effects supervisor. He's also a superb artist in his own right.
Absolutely.
And Sid and Matt Aris would take it from there and just design the shot.
And Best of Both Worlds is revered amongst, you know, Next Generation fans. It's a great episode. I think Rob Legato was also nominated with you. He was visual effects supervisor on that. But there was Eric Nash and Gary Hudson. And there's a lot of great people in that. But I was just going to ask you this. The work on that sequence, I mean, it is a really amazing effort for an episodic television show. It must have felt time.
For its day, it was pretty good. Of course, what they're doing now is nothing short of miraculous, and they're doing it in a quarter of the time. Star Trek was an extremely well-produced and well-organized show, so we had scripts months in advance of when the shots were needed, which is unheard of in television. Only when you really, really know what you're doing can you have the luxury of working with that sort of schedule, and that's one of the reasons why the effects for Star Trek were so good.
But I was going to say that 91 Emmy nomination, 91, you were still pre-digital, right? Because you kind of transitioned between 91 and about, what, 96 into digital?
Well, I guess the first shot in which we had a digital element was in the first Addams Family movie.
That underwater ceiling grotto water comp.
Exactly right. That was the first digital element. It just all sort of expanded from there, and it proceeded stepwise. I mean, we continued to do original negative shots right up until Dorothy Day, the movie about the Catholic nun. So because they're so easy, you know, there's no infrastructure, there's no scanning, there's no recording, there's no film out. It's just thread the negative up in the camera. So we continued to use original negative until there was really no point.
In that period, you were doing some amazing work, from Cape Fear to Dragonheart. I loved that. But you also did Chaplin with Richard Attenborough, didn't you? In 82.
Yes. Yes.
What was that?
That was wonderful. Well, it was a great experience. First of all, Lord Attenborough is just a fantastic guy, and he is a lord now, isn't he?
He's certainly a sir. I don't know if he's a lawyer, but he probably is.
Yeah, I think he may have. I don't know. I don't keep track of the honors list. But at any rate, he Dickie, as he likes to be called, incredibly, was a joy to work with. And he and Al were just exactly on the same wavelength. And we did some terrific shots. I'm very proud of the big pullback from the Hollywood sign, for example, and the shot where they're steaming away from New York. The shot off the fantail of the Queen Mary, I think, is really a first class.
That Hollywood sign, was that the Hollywood Land sign? Am I remembering?
It was the Hollywood Land sign. That's exactly right. That was before. That was when it was still an advert for a real estate development before it became a cultural icon.
You mentioned earlier Robert Stromberg, and I need to come back to him. I should have guessed I'd done that, because he worked on the Borg ships for Star Trek, didn't he?
He did.
Talk to me about working with Robert Stromberg.
Well, Rob was a matte painting artist, already quite well-formed. He had done some low-budget television on his own, and working with his dad, William Stromberg, who was a visual effects producer, and Rob's brother, incidentally, is a film composer Bill Stromberg is just a fabulous, fabulous composer, orchestrator, conductor. So it's an incredibly talented family, just a preposterously talented family. And at any rate, Rob came to us already with considerable chops as a matte painter. I don't remember where he got our name, but he had heard of us and we had heard of him, and he came over and showed us some of the stuff that he'd been doing on this silly TV show. which was, you know, Saturday morning, you know, Saturday morning TV show that had some science fiction, had a science fiction theme, and he was doing great shots. I mean, the guy could really paint. He was completely self-taught, and he was just a phenomenon. And now, of course, he won two Oscars in a row for production design, and now he's directing. So God knows where Rob will stop.
I mean, yeah. He'll never stop. I mean, he was nominated also for Master and Commander as visual effects, and then to win for art direction on Avatar and Alice.
Yes.
But I mean,
yes.
the work he did on, I mean, he's done episodic television work, of course, and John Adams and Broadway Empire, and of course the Star Trek stuff. So yeah, so walk me through then, you know, the sort of dawn of the 2000s. So there was U571, which I loved as a film, and then.
Mm-hmm.
What, Time Machine? You even guys worked on Bourne Identity, didn't you?
We did. We did.
What was that period like? Because now we're very much digital, and you guys made the transition primarily via Mac.
We had made the transition completely by that time, with the exception of, you know, as I say, with the exception of the occasional original negative match shot. You know, those were all, you know, very important movies.
Am I right in thinking that you made the transition via a Macintosh kind of rather than SGI kind of route at the company?
That's exactly right. We were very fortunate early on to run into a man called Richard Patterson, who had worked for a company that I had a small ownership position in called Ultimat. And Richard was one of these smart guys who can basically do anything he wants to do because his head is screwed on straight. And Richard had at one point been the editor of the American Cinematographer magazine, for example. And he has become since his Illusion Arts days, he's become a color scientist of great repute, and has worked heavily with the Academy on things like the Digital Cinema Initiative and the whole color science effort at the Bickford Center. So anyway, Richard, when we had the very good fortune to get Richard when he left Ultimat, and Richard just set us up. You know, we said, look, you know, what can you do with desktop computers? And he says, well, with Macintoshes, I think I can do a lot, and he could. You know, so while everyone else was going into debt for hundreds of thousands of dollars, we were just buying Macintoshes off the, retail chain and doing what we needed to do in Photoshop. This was even before After Effects. Richard worked out a way for us to do composites with Photoshop macros.
Hmm.
And talk about a long and involved process and a difficult way to work, but it was doable, and we did it, and we didn't even have a network. You know, we carried drives around from computer to computer.
Sneakernet.
Exactly right, Sneakernet, and it did the job. I guess our first show that had a lot of digital green screens in it was Beverly Hills Cop 3, which had this whole sequence with Eddie Murphy on the spider ride. But that was just a revelation, because all the stuff that worked with great difficulty or just barely worked photographically suddenly worked really, really well.
I heard somewhere that of the films that you did in that last decade at Illusion Arts, that one of your favorites was the film Casanova. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Can you talk to me about that?
Well, it was, first of all, you know, 2 months in Venice. Come on, not a bad gig. And in the second place, the team that we worked with was just, I don't think it's ever been matched on any movie I've ever worked on. It's just marvelous. Lasse Hallström was the director. The screenwriter, uncredited, unfortunately, was Tom Stoppard. David Gropman, who just nominated for production design for The Life of Pi, was the production designer. Albert Stapleton, a sensational Brit cameraman, was the DP. I mean, it was just first class all the way, and we had tremendous cooperation from Venice, unlike our previous trip there for The Honest Courtesan, where they didn't want to know. Here they couldn't do enough for us. They stopped traffic on the Grand Canal for minutes at a time so we could film our scenes. The Commune de Venezia was unbelievably helpful, and you know, we had remarkably good weather most of the time, and didn't have too many floods, and it was just a great place to work.
Lasse Hallström, the director.
A wonderful movie.
isn't really known as an effects director. What was the relationship like with the director in terms of doing your effects
work? Well, in the first place, he took his lead from David Grobman, the production designer, and Oliver and me. He had, he knew what we could do. He knew our work. We had a couple of extensive interviews with him before he hired us. So we were people that he could deal with. And he was, he was great to work with. He was articulate, and he could tell you what he wanted, and he could tell you what he didn't like. He couldn't draw. I guess that's the only way he could possibly have been. I guess that was the only way he could possibly have been better as a director, if he could draw like James Cameron can. But that's fine. I'll listen. He knew how to tell us what he wanted.
That film, obviously, you used a lot of different techniques in. In fact, I think you sort of once were quoted as saying you used everything you had in the toolbox. Is that right?
Yep, absolutely right. Well, everything except original negative. There aren't any original negative thoughts in that movie. But we used everything. We had an interesting take, or what was it, at the time, an interesting take on crowd multiplication. By then, of course, by the time of Casanova, Weta's massive program for creating crowds was well developed, and it was an option for us to use Massive to create our big crowds in Casanova, like the crowd that surrounds the gallows in the Piazza San Marco when Casanova and Francesca are going to be hanged. But Massive is expensive, and there's a lot of overhead to creating the agents or the people that are in Massive. So we came up with a method. Me and Mary Manning, our previous artist, and the other folks at Illusion Arts came up with this idea of photographing, and I'm sure it wasn't a new idea even then, was photographing people against green screen in small groups. We had 50 people, and I think we had 3 changes of costume for them, and we threw those 50 people up against green screen at this sort of compromised camera height, given that the camera had to move during most of these shots. So basically, we had a bunch of green screen, animated green screen cutouts that we could position in the scene like cards in the traditional digital graphics sense of cards. They weren't images. They weren't images projected on cards. They were actual 3-dimensional alpha channel cutouts of characters in space, positioned on the ground in space and match moved to our camera moves. So with 50 people, we got a crowd of thousands and. And I think, with costume changes and various cheats and tricks, I think quite convincingly, and they were enormously useful, because we had I don't remember how many days we had at the Piazza San Marco, but it wasn't enough, and we had unexpected glitches, like we weren't allowed to use our electric camera car on the Piazza San Marco. So that was a surprise that slowed us way down. At any rate, we lost enough days on the Piazza San Marco that we had to shoot a whole bunch of pickups, and we put big green screens up in the parking lot, which was just off the island, just on the other side of the bridge. There was a big we had a big screen, big parking lot, and a big disused industrial building. So we put up our green screens and did a bunch of green screen photography, both outdoors in sunlight and indoors, to fill in the gaps.
So Illusion Arts finished in 2008, I believe. Was Milk the last...
2009, I think. It was just about 3 years ago.
Was Milk the last film, or was it Defiance?
It was one of the last... It was the last big film. I think it was the last film of any size that Sid and I really supervised. We did a bunch of work for other supervisors like Robert Stad, Dan Curry, John Ferret. We have many other supervisors that we have very good relationships with and do to this day. But the Milk was the last film that we really supervised, and as I said, we had done 6 films with Gus by then, so ranging from very popular to extremely obscure, like Jerry.
Yeah, I mean, Milk was a terrific film. It was really.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, really good.
I thought so.
You obviously
there's a big crowd shot at one point. Sean Penn as Harvey Milk is addressing this enormous crowd in a plaza in San Francisco. Camera follows him up the podium and pans across this enormous crowd, and we had a bit of fun there. Many of the people in the crowd are us, our Illusion Arts folks. We did the same people on a card trick, but a lot of the since no period order was required, a lot of those people are us.
And you said you've been doing other things with Zoic, of course, such as Lawless, which I think came out last year. I wonder if I could quote you, though, something interesting that you said recently, as we did at the start of this interview, which is to do with the idea that, and I believe this is a direct quote, years ago, special effects men like Ray Harryhausen could do all the effects in a movie by himself, and then came Star Wars and you needed an army just to do one film. And now with the digital revolution, it's getting back to the point where one good artist in his garage with a desktop computer can do a beautiful shot. I think it's come full circle. Do you think that's still true? I mean, is that how you feel?
In that respect, it has. And this has had, of course, like every other blessing, it's not unmixed. This has had good and bad consequences. The good consequence, of course, is that an artist, assuming that an artist, comes to view like Ray Harryhausen, of the stature of Ray Harryhausen, who wants to do a film where he is the primary, not only creative force, but also the primary executant, if that's the word, it would be possible, because the software, the software is there, the hardware is there, You can't get really terrific quality from a DSLR, but you can get okay quality. So, a person could do a sort of garage film that could be very presentable on a big screen. And of course, Ray never really did work alone. He always worked with other sculptors and model makers and machinists and so on. And sometimes he worked with major artists like Jim Danforth and David Allen and Roger Dickin. Ray was always the primary force, and so that day has, I stand by that. That day has come again. Now that's also had a downside, and that means that it is possible for mom and pop companies to form a visual effects producing company, visual effects facility, and that's fine for them. But the problem is that when you're pretty much on your own, when you've just got a few people under your roof, you have no clout with the studios. If you're dealing with studios instead of doing work for yourself, you have no negotiating power, because there are 50 other little mom and pop shops. Every time a visual effects company goes out of business, a sadly frequent occurrence these days, but every time a visual effects company goes out of business, their people scatter. It's like the diaspora, these people scatter and little mom and pop visual effects companies spring up out of the remains. And some of those mom and pop companies grow and become bigger companies like Cafe Effects. And some of them stay small and they do fantastic work, but they have no clout with the producers. So they work for rock bottom prices and it makes it very, very hard for anyone to sort of break out of that cycle. So for the producer who tends to think of visual effects as just being different brands of peas that are pretty much identical, it's very hard for a sort of medium-sized company to stay in business. It was not possible for us to stay in business, for example, even though we'd been in business for 26 years.
So even with your skill bank and incredible reputations, the commodification of the visual effects kind of worked against you?
It did. And what's happened is we've sort of regret. I just did an article for one of the union magazines. It's like we've sort of regressed to a pre-industrial model. In the old days, when watches were made, the whole watch wasn't made in one place. You'd go to one little company, which was probably a mom-and-pop family business, for the watch spring, for the crystal, for the case, for the gear wheels, for the axles, for the jewels, etc., for the dials, etc., etc., etc. And all those pieces would be put together by one, today we would call an aggregator, who probably designed the watch in the first place. And that's a good model in terms of it gives very good, it can, if you can ride herd on all these individual producers, if you can ride herd and get a consistent look out of them, you can get a terrific result. But it becomes it becomes very, very hard to break out of that mold and to you know, move into doing more ambitious work that you just can't do as a mom and pop shop. So what's happened now, basically, is there are dozens and dozens of small and usually highly capable visual effects companies that seem to go in and out of business almost on a picture-by-picture basis, and there are a very few sort of medium-sized companies left, and then there are the behemoths like Digital Domain and Industrial Light and Magic and Rhythm and Hues, who have developed specialties that so far the producers haven't been able to buy for pennies on the dollar.
You've also been a little critical, I think, haven't you, of the payment schedules in terms of that model?
Well, it's just a basic tenet of business. That is that you need to stay ahead of your payroll. You need to have income. You need to have income that matches your expenses. And the payment schedules on features, unless you can negotiate your contract very aggressively, the payment schedules on features are just stretched out and out and out and out, and then finally there's a big payment at the end. Well, by that time, you're starving. And when unfortunately, people have found themselves, because of that, because they're on the wrong end of the deal financially, they found themselves susceptible to, I think, some very sort of lamentable business practices. Producers insisting that you do a whole bunch of additional work at no cost.
You've also commented on, I believe the words were, the tardiness of the state of California in enacting tax incentives to combat runaway productions.
Well, that's an old story by now. I mean, over 10 years ago, I made the comparison of Lockheed Aircraft, which is the Burbank Airport parking lot used to be Lockheed Aircraft, the greatest experimental aircraft factory in the history of the world, probably. I mean, the SR-71 Blackbird, the U-2, all these incredible experimental planes. The stealth technology was developed there, where the Panda restaurant is there. And it's gone, and it's gone because there's a more congenial atmosphere in Washington. So, unfortunately, my prediction that the movie industry was going to dry up and blow away, it has become completely true, but it's become truer and truer. It's harder and harder to find movies being made in California. And, we're not asking for the world. We're just asking for a level playing field.
So in finishing, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the, I mean, are there opportunities still, or do you feel that...
Well, I can't help but be optimistic, and I'll tell you why, and I've said this before. I get around, I'm involved in the Visual Effects Society, I'm involved in the Academy Visual Effects branch, I have colleagues all over the world, and everywhere I go, I meet these people, and they are, without exception, the best and the brightest there is in the movie world. They are just the absolute top rank, the brightest people, the most ingenious people. And if we can just work together, we can be a formidable force and really become a force for good, and a force for good that will work in favor of everyone, not just the visual effects companies, but the individual visual effects artists who are not represented by unions. We're the only major film category that has no union. I think we have to be the biggest industry associated with the movie business that, in terms of dollars spent, that doesn't have a trade association. How are these things even possible? Well, it's possible because when times are good, people don't focus on things like that. And when times are bad, people are scared to death. They don't want to rock the boat. But we have the power. We have the leadership. We have, God knows, we have the brains. If we just use it, if we just focus ourselves, we can make the industry better for everybody, not just for us, but not just for the visual effects companies, but for the individual artists, and for our clients, the producers.
Well, look, it's been a great pleasure talking to you at some length about your career and also your opinions on the industry. And I congratulate you again for being recognized
by
the Academy. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, sir. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for that, Bill and Mike. I've been wanting to get Bill on the FX podcast, as I mentioned at the beginning, for quite a while now. And it just hasn't worked out schedule-wise. So when I saw the Academy was honoring him with this honor, I really wanted nothing more to shift the interview from a business issue discussion to one where Mike and Bill could sit down and really have a broad discussion like this. I know I'll be listening to this one more than once myself. Before we go, I just wanted to mention our FX Insider program. This is our membership program that offers insiders access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work that we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. And I think you'll want to check out the most recent episode, which is our Oscar wrap-up, which is always a popular episode, including a visit by Todd Vasari with his Oscar Predictinator. The RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produce a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And also check out our sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.